foul hook through his wing, nearly, said the second man. That's five.
Balfour saw that they had dropped a square of biscuit on the gravel below. The stevedore, who had spoken first, nodded his head at Balfour and said,
Are you wanting to chase up Carver, or chase up the other one?
Neither, Balfour said.
Never mind, never mind.
I've got no quarrel with Francis Carver. You remember that?
I'll remember, said the stevedore. And then, I say, though, if you're wanting dirt, and on the sly, you ought to ask the jailer.
Balfour was watching the gull circle closer.
The jailer? Shepherd? Why?
Why? Because Carver did time under Shepherd, said the stevedore. On Cockatoo Island, for all of 10 years. Carver dug the dry dock there, convict labour, with Shepherd looking on. If you're wanting dirt on Carver, I'd make a bet that Gov Shepherd is the man to dig it up.
At Cockatoo? Balfour said with interest. I didn't know Shepherd was a sergeant at Cockatoo.
He was. And then the very year after Carver gets his leave, Shepherd gets a transfer to New Zealand, and follows him. How's that for bad luck?
The worst, agreed his fellow. How do you know this? Balfour said. The stevedore was addressing his mate.
That's a face I'd never want to see again. My jailer, day in and day out for 10 years, and then as soon as I'm free...
How do you know this? Balfour persisted.
I apprenticed on the dockyards there, the stevedore said. Aye, now, that's a conker!
For he had struck the gull across the back with his stick. You don't happen to know what Carver was booked for, do you, lad?
Trafficking, the stevedore said immediately.
Trafficking what?
Opium.
What? Into China? Or out?
Couldn't tell you.
Who booked him, though? Not the Crown. The stevedore thought about this, and then shrugged.
I don't really know, he said. I thought it was something to do with opium, but maybe that was just something I heard.
Presently Balfour bid them both goodbye, and moved along the spit. As soon as he was well alone, he planted his feet apart, thrust his hands into his pockets, and looked out over the white roar of the ocean, past the screwjacks and greased rollers, past the wooden lighthouse at the spit's far end, past the dark hulks of the ships that had foundered on the bar.
See now, he muttered to himself. That's something. There's something all right. Carver must be the man's real name. He can't be using an alias. Not in Hokitika under the jailer's own nose, when he served time beneath the man in a penitentiary.
Balfour slicked his moustache with his finger and thumb.
Here's the rub, though. What in heaven's name provoked him to make the claim, with proof in writing to boot, that his name was Francis Wells?
Saturn in Libra, in which Joseph Pritchard outlines his theory of conspiracy, George Shepherd makes a calculated offer, and Harold Nielsen agrees in a tone of remonstration to pay a call upon R. Cui. It was at this point that Balfour's role as narrator was usurped, a transferal that was marked on the shipping agent's part by the lighting of a new cigar, the filling of a fresh glass, and an enthusiastic, "Now correct me if I'm wrong, boys!" This exhortation was apparently directed at two persons, Joseph Pritchard, the dark-haired man on Moody's left, whose stifled intensity of silence was matched, as Moody soon discovered, by the stifled intensity of his unhurried speech, and another man whose physical presence we have not yet had cause to remark. This second man had been playing at billiards when Moody first made his entrance. Balfour now introduced him, with an admiring thrust of his cigar, as Harold Nielsen, born in Oslo, late of Bath, undefeated master of the three-card brag, and a damned fine shot, to which Nielsen added, springing forward to augment his own commendation, that he carried a muzzle-loading Enfield musket, the British Empire's finest, and the only firearm he had ever deigned to touch. These two men were more than willing to take Balfour's exhortation at face value. Nielsen, for reasons of vanity, if he could not bear to be the leading role in a sensational tale, and not the leading actor, too, and Pritchard for reasons of precision. We shall therefore leave Thomas Balfour standing on the wharf with his hands in his pockets, squinting into the rain. We shall turn our gaze some 200 yards to the north, and alight at the auction yards on Gibson Quay, where, behind the rostrum, an unpainted door leading to a private office bears the legend Nielsen & Co. Commission Merchants. In deference to the harmony of the turning spheres of time, we shall resume our tale exactly at the moment Balfour left off, in Hokitika, on Saturday the 27th of January, at 1:05 in the afternoon. At midday on a Saturday, Harold Nielsen could usually be found in his office, sitting before a stack of contracts, wills, and bills of lading, patting his breast every 10 minutes or so to check again the silver pocket watch that would release him to his luncheon, which he took with medical regularity each day at the Nonpareil. Nielsen recommended this routine to any who would listen, believing very stoutly in the curative properties of dark gravy, pastry, and ale. He did much recommendation, in fact, and often made an example of his own customs for the profit of other, less visionary men. He derived an especial pleasure from argument, so long as it was of the preposterous hypothetical variety, and so loved to fashion absurd theories of abstraction from the small but dedicated circle of his own tastes. This attitude was affectionately reinforced by his friends, who thought him vivacious and amusing, and scorned by his detractors, who thought him affected and self-absorbed. But these latter voices were subdued in Nielsen's ears, and he spent no effort to better make them out. Harold Nielsen was famous in Hokitika for the high style of his dress. That afternoon he was wearing a knee-length frock coat with silk-faced lapels of a charcoal hue, a dark red vest, a grey bow tie, and cashmere-striped morning trousers. His silk hat, which was hanging on a hat-stand behind his desk, was of the same charcoal hue as his coat. Beneath it was propped a silver-tipped stick with a curved handle. To complete this costume, for so he perceived of his daily dress, as a costume that could be completed to effect, he smoked a pipe, a fat calabash with a bitten-down stem, though his affection for the instrument had less to do with the pleasures of the habit than for the opportunity for emphasis it provided. He often held it in his teeth unlit, and spoke out of the corner of his mouth, like a comic player delivering an aside, a comparison which suited him. For if Nielsen was vain of the impressions he created, it was because he knew that he created them very well. Today, however, the mahogany bowl was warm, and he was pulling on the stem with considerable agitation. The hour of his luncheon was past, but he was not thinking of his stomach, and nor of the ruddy-cheeked barmaid at the Nonpareil, who called him Harry and always saved the choicest edges of the pie-crust for his plate. He was frowning down at a yellow bill